and worked out projects. We have projects needed in North America. It may be a tall order, but this is what we have to do, because the opposite of that is chaos and global NATO war. We don't have a choice.
All right. And on that note, unfortunately, we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me. Paul Craig Roberts, Chairman, Institute for Political Economy and former Assistant Secretary of U.S. Treasury out of Atlanta. And out of Washington, D.C., Marcia Baker, economic expert. Thank you both for being with us. And thank you for staying with us on Another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 36 through 38 from the Surah Nahl, recited by Qasim Razi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولقد بعثنا في كل أمة رسولا أن اعبدوا الله واجتنبوا الطاغوت فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ هَدَى اللَّهُ وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ حَقَّتْ عَلَيْهِ الضَّلَالَةِ فَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَانْظُرُوا كَيْفَ كَانَ عَاقِبَةُ المكذبين إن تحرص على هداهم فإن الله لا يهدي من يضل وما لهم من ناصرين وأقسموا بالله جهد أيمانهم لا يبعث الله من يموت بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And certainly we raise in every nation an apostle, saying, serve Allah and shun the Satan. So there were some of them whom Allah guided, and there were others against whom error was due. Therefore travel in the land, then see what was the end of the rejecters. If you desire further guidance, yet surely Allah does not guide him who leads astray, nor shall they have any helpers. And they swear by Allah with the most energetic of their oath, Allah will not raise up him who dies. Yeah, is a promise binding on him, quite true, but most people do not know.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran unveils a new strategic ballistic missile on the anniversary marking the liberation of the city of Khorramshahr in 1982. Russia says the use of U.S.-made military hardware in an attack on its border region proves the growing role of the West in the Ukraine war. U.S. stocks take a tumble for a second day as negotiations aimed at heading off a looming government debt default remain deadlocked. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Iran has unveiled a new fourth generation ballistic missile on the anniversary marking the liberation of the city of Khorramshahr during the Iran-Iraq war.
The missile has a range of 2,000 kilometers and a warhead which has high explosive power. The missile is capable to carry various warheads.
The top general said one of the main distinctive features of the missile is its radar evasion capability and passing through enemies' air defenses. According to the Defense Ministry, its high-tech engine is operated with liquid fuel. Its speed is 8 Mach in air and 16 Mach in outer space. The new missile can be guided in mid-flight, which helps its precision. Iran in recent years has developed its homegrown missile capabilities. Last year, the country unveiled a number of missiles, including a hypersonic one. Our correspondent Gisumi Shahmadi told us more about the newly unveiled long-range Iranian missile.
This missile, it is named after the city Khorramshahr, which was liberated and is the liberation anniversary of the city. So it is named after the city of Khorramshahr. It is a fourth-generation long-range ballistic missile. It is a liquid-fueled missile, and the most important issue regarding this missile that was unveiled today is that it is a stealth missile, meaning that it can hit any target precisely with 100% accuracy. It is a precision-guided munition as well. And it is the defense military capabilities will not be able to detect this missile. For Khorramshahr itself, for Iranians, it is a symbol of resistance and determination. The missile, the long-range ballistic missile, is dubbed after this city to show exactly how far Iran has come in its defense capabilities and the fact that it does not rely on any country in order to defend its borders. Not only that, it can be considered as a force that can promote peace and security in the region.
The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, has traveled to Indonesia at the head of a high-ranking politico-economic delegation. Raisi has hailed the visit as a platform for expanding cooperation in various fields as well as further improvement of bilateral ties. The visit is part of Iran's policy of pivoting to Asia and cementing cooperation with Muslim countries.
The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, has made an official visit to Indonesia at the head of a high-ranking politico-economic delegation. During a joint presser conference with his Indonesian counterpart, Joko Widodo, Raisi said Iran and Indonesia aim to increase their trade value to $20 billion.
As a result of this visit, there will be significant steps taken in the development of bilateral relations. We have set goals for development of trade and economic ties between the two countries from the current levels to the tune of $20 billion.
Raisi also said that both sides are resolute on promoting exchanges using national currencies.
If we don't want to say dollars, then we can say it in terms of the same level of investment in rupiah and rial, which are the national currencies of the two countries. We intend to work with this country, Indonesia, and other nations in our national currencies.
Presidents of Iran and Indonesia also signed a preferential trade agreement to expand economic relations. Indonesian President Joko Widodo said he hoped the agreement would increase trade between the two countries.
Today, Indonesia and Iran have signed a preferential trade agreement. We hope that it will increase trade between Indonesia and Iran. President Raisi and I also talked about the creation of a B2B agreement and also development investments in the Nusantara capital and solution to the oil and gas sector investment.
The Iranian president said the signing of different documents for bilateral cooperation in various sectors reaffirms both sides' will to develop relations in all fields. In the presence of Raisi and Widodo, senior officials of Iran and Indonesia signed 11 documents and agreements to strengthen cooperation in preferential trade, cancellation of visas, cultural exchanges, supervision over the pharmaceutical products, science and technology, as well as oil and gas. Raisi also said oppressive sanctions and pressure have failed to hinder Iran's progress, expressing Tehran's firm determination to improve relations with Muslim and neighboring states.
Before his departure, President Raisi said Iran and Indonesia are united against unilateralism. The two countries have agreed to increase their trade volume to $20 billion and use their own national currencies. These achievements are a testimony to Tehran's will to confront unilateralism and expand cooperation with other Muslim states.
During his visit to Indonesia, Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, once again stated Tehran's firm determination to improve relations with Muslim and neighboring states. He said the expansion of ties with Indonesia as one of the important and effective countries in Asia and the world and a member of important regional and international organizations is very important for Iran. He added that despite pressure and oppressive sanctions, the Iranian youths have succeeded in taking major steps towards the improvement of science and technology as well as the country's economic development. He noted that Iran and Indonesia enjoy diverse capacities to deepen relations and expressed hope that his visit to Jakarta would lead to constructive outcomes for the expansion of ties between the two powerful Muslim countries in the region and the world. He added that Tehran and Jakarta have a common stance on key regional and global issues, including Palestine and Afghanistan. He also stressed the importance of establishing an inclusive government in Afghanistan with the participation of all ethnic and religious groups, which strives to restore the Afghan people's rights. Raisi said 2 decades of U.S. presence in Afghanistan has had no outcome but destruction and death of the Afghan people. The Iranian president emphasized that Iran and Indonesia believe in serious fight against unilateralism in the regional and international issues.
climate activists in the German capital Berlin has staged a rally to denounce the government for its lackluster response to the climate crisis. Protesters dressed in orange vests and holding banners took part in what was dubbed a slow march through the capital. They blocked streets and caused traffic disruption. The group known as Last Generation has staged several demonstrations in the past year. They want Germany to stop using fossil fuels by 2030 and also take some short-term measures to cut transport emissions. The activists have repeatedly accused the government of ignoring its responsibilities, saying that it has already lost a significant amount of time to take action.
For some people, what we are doing here is already too late. Some people have already been killed in the floods in Germany, and some have been killed in the floods in Italy.
Last Generation held the rally a day after German police raided homes and searched property of 15 of its members. Police say they seized assets as part of an investigation into the climate group's finances. The government has been extremely critical of the group's protesting tactics. Last Generation has repeatedly blocked roads across the country and targeted artworks and exhibitions. Authorities say such actions are counterproductive, but climate activists argue that these are the only ways they can make the government heed to their calls. Moscow strongly condemned the use of U.S.-made military hardware in a recent raid on a Russian border region by pro-Ukrainian forces. The Kremlin says the development proves the growing involvement of the West in the Ukraine war. The Kremlin spokesman said the West is delivering more military equipment to Ukraine to be used against Russian forces. Dmitry Peskov added this issue proves that Western countries' direct and indirect role in the conflict is growing by the day. He said Russia is pursuing these developments and is drawing the appropriate conclusions. His remarks came after the Russian Defense Ministry issued a stern warning over the attack on the border area, pledging an extremely harsh response.
On May 22nd, a unit of the Ukrainian Nationalist Formation invaded the territory of the Russian Federation in the area of the international checkpoint in the Belgrade region. In the course of the counter-terrorist operation, the Nationalist Formations were blocked and defeated by airstrikes, artillery fire, and the active actions of the Western military district units covering the state border. The remaining Nationalists were driven back to the territory of Ukraine, where they were completely eliminated. More than 70 Ukrainian terrorists were eliminated, as well as machinery and armored vehicles. We will continue to respond promptly and harshly to such actions by Ukrainian militants.
Shoigu described the move as a terrorist act by Ukraine against Russian civilians. Kiev, however, has denied any role in the assault, which has been claimed by two anti-Kremlin far-right armed groups. White House spokesman John Kirby has reacted to the incident, saying Washington does not support the use of U.S.-made equipment for attacks inside Russia. He added that the U.S. is looking into reports that its military vehicles were used in the cross-border incursion. U.S. stocks have taken a tumble for a second day as negotiations seek to head off a looming government debt default remain deadlocked. On Wednesday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average said 0.8%. The S&P fell 0.7%, while NASDAQ dropped 0.6 percentage points. This says talks still continue between the White House and the House of Representatives to raise the government's borrowing limit. President Joe Biden has offered to freeze government spending at current levels. The move would reduce the government's deficit by $1 trillion. The White House has criticized Republicans, saying that averting default is the responsibility of Congress, and preventing such a situation is not a concession. The U.S. is rather in for crippling default as early as June the 1st. If Congress does not lift the debt ceiling, the default would leave millions of Americans without paychecks. It could also trigger a recession, destroying millions of jobs and businesses. Australian police have begun a legal proceeding against an officer over the killing of an elderly woman at a care home.
New South Wales Police have commenced legal action against a 33-year-old senior constable from Monaro Police District for the offences of recklessly inflict grievous bodily harm, assault occasioning actual bodily harm, and assault.
Christian White, who was charged with three offences, is due to appear in court on the 5th of July. He remains suspended from duty with pay while investigations continue. Last week, 95-year-old Claire Noland was tasered after staff found her holding a knife and wandering around her home in Cooma, a town in New South Wales state. She was suffering from dementia. Nolan was admitted to hospital with his head injuries when she fell to the floor after being tasered. She passed away on Wednesday. The case has caused an outrage in the country and brought into focus the use of force by police. The UN chief has warned that the Horn of Africa is in dire need of help as the world body pledges $2.4 billion in humanitarian assistance for the region.
We must act now to prevent crisis from turning into catastrophe. Make no mistake, action will make all the difference. Last year, thanks to generous support from donor countries, we delivered life-saving assistance to 20 million people, and we helped avert a famine. Now support must match the scale of the challenge.
The sum raised by the UN is considerably less than $7 billion that it says it needed to prevent a worst-case scenario in the Horn of Africa. According to the UN, crises brought on by drought, displacement, and famine have put the lives of 43 million people in danger. People across Somalia, Ethiopia, and Kenya are in urgent need of life-saving support. While the UN chief says fighting in Sudan is radiating instability across the region, UN officials blame climate change for drought and growing hunger-related deaths in Africa. May 25th marks the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon. In the year 2000, Israeli troops were forced to withdraw unconditionally after the Lebanese resistance inflicted heavy losses on them. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh reports.
On May 24th of the year 2000, Lebanese masses flocked to their hometowns and villages in a surprise move that shocked the Israeli army and sent the Israeli collaborators fleeing towards northern occupied Palestine.
Towns witnessed over 18 years of Israeli occupation, terrorism, killing and destruction. Thanks to the strategy of attrition adopted by the resistance movement, the Israeli army was left with no option but to withdraw unconditionally from the land it had occupied.
Since then, Lebanon has celebrated May 25th as a national day of resistance and liberation.
We earned our freedom. It wasn't like they said, oh, we left. No, they didn't left. We make them leave.
Hassan was forced to leave his hometown during the Israeli occupation. He recalls how terrorized he was as a child when the Israelis first invaded South Lebanon.
I was forced to leave my land on 1982. And I was unable to come back until after 2000. It was a great moment. I can tell the difference, like when we used to drive or when we was kids. My parents used to say, don't look, don't smile, don't do nothing, don't breathe even. That's how much we were scared.
Today he brings his son to see the fruit of years of struggle.
After, you know, withdrawal in 2000, you can see the smile in the face of the people. Especially the children, they can and they can play and they can walk around in peace, and they are really happy to go to come back to their homeland, which we really paid a lot of blood to get it back. And we are looking forward really for the Palestinians to live and to have the same feeling as we feel.
The fruit of liberation is seen by the people of Lebanon as a natural outcome of resistance. And they have voiced their support and encouragement to the Palestinian people that someday they too will be free. Mariam Saleh, Odaisi, South Lebanon.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Of May, the day of resistance and resilience. The 25th of May has been officially designated as the day of resistance and resilience in the Iranian Solar Hijri calendar, and refers to the staunch resistance and resilience of the people of Desfoul, a town in southwestern Iran, which emerged from the eight-year imposed war defiant and unbowed, even though it came under a persistent and frequent barrage of Iraqi Baathist missiles and rockets, which lasted for years. The town of Desfoul, in Khuzestan province, is known as the capital of resistance to this day, because of the valiant resistance of its people under harshest of conditions in the 1980s, during the eight-year imposed war. Please stay with us for more. Desfoul is located in northern Khuzestan province, a town in southwestern Iran. Despite the fact that the town was subjected to almost daily barrages of missiles by the Iraqi Baathist regime, the courageous people of Darfur constantly rebuilt those parts of their town which had come under attack and refused to abandon their homes. The resilient people of Darfur dashed the hopes of the Ba'athist invaders. The people of Darfur never surrendered under toughest of conditions, even when Iraqi Ba'athist missiles were raining down on them. Every Friday, the local people, along with the young fighters and defenders of the town, took part in Friday prayers, with Ayatollah Ghazi as their Friday prayers leader. Despite the threats and intimidation by the Ba'athist regime and pressure on the people of Darfur to evacuate their town, the courageous and defiant locals never abandoned their town and made sure that the Ba'athist dream of capturing an abandoned Darfur remained just that, a dream which never saw the light of day. The town of Darfur was targeted so often by Iraqi Ba'athist missiles during the war that it became known as the Town of Missiles. In fact, in 8 years of imposed war, Darfur was hit by 176 Iraqi ground-to-ground missiles, 2,500 heavy artillery shells, and 331 air-to-surface missiles fired by the Iraqi Air Force. Over 19,000 homes and businesses in the town of Darfur were destroyed, but the people of Darfur never gave up. They never surrendered, and quite rightly became the symbol of resistance and the symbol of resilience in the Islamic Republic of Iran. The town offered a total of 2,600 martyrs to Islam and to the Islamic Revolution, 250 of whom were children. What amazed the people of Iran, as well as the wider world, was the resilience of the people of Darfur and their unstinting, generous and tireless assistance to the fighters of Islam during 8 years of sacred defence. Life in the beleaguered town of Darfur went on, despite all the hardships. The people of Darfur tolerated Ba'athist missile strikes day after day, month after month, and year after year. Many of the town's residents were martyred during this extremely difficult period of time. But the people of Darfur wholeheartedly resisted the Iraqi invasion and defended their town and country tooth and nail. Their steadfastness and their resilience became a national honour, a badge of honour for the Islamic Republic of Iran. But why did the Ba'athist military forces concentrate their attacks on this small town in Khuzestan province in southwestern Iran? After all, Darfur's location was not particularly strategic. The town had no industrial or economic significance of any kind. It was not a military centre. There were no guns or ammunition depots in Darfur. And it wasn't a centre of political or military decision-making. So why did the Ba'athist army consign two of its six active divisions to conquering Darfur? Despite all their efforts, the Iraqi Ba'athists never conquered Darfur, and they only advanced as far as the Kalkhe River, close to the town, but they never actually managed to capture Darfur. If the town of Darfur had fallen to the Iraqis, this would have been a huge psychological blow to the Iranian forces, and conceivably the whole province of Khuzestan may then have been captured by Saddam's army. But the heroic resistance of the people of Darfur scuppered this and prevented the Ba'athist advance into southwestern Iran.
Thank you.
quite rightly, the people of this fall are regarded as real heroes of 8 years of sacred defence. But they also paid a huge price for their epic resistance. The people of this fall offered 2,600 martyrs, 4,000 injured veterans and amputees, 452 prisoners of war, and 147 young men listed officially as missing in action. The founder of the Islamic Revolution, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, paid homage to the people of this fall for their epic resistance. The Imam said, "The people of this fall have been tested and they came through with flying colours. They paid their dues to Islam and to the Islamic Revolution." The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has also commented on the heroic resistance of the people of this fall during 8 years of sacred defence. Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The Iraqi Ba'athist forces had invaded the desert of Abbas and they were here in large number near this fall. They wanted to cross the bridge over the Karkhe River and come into the town of this fall. But this was prevented by the heroic resistance of the people of this fall. The late Ayatollah Ghazi refused to leave this fall." The Friday prayers imam, Ayatollah Ghazi, who refused to leave the town, this effectively meant that the people of this fall remained in the town, and the town was never evacuated. If this fall had been evacuated and was empty of people, this would have been a huge blow to the Islamic Iranian forces. The late Ayatollah Ghazi, who was blinded in one eye, chose to remain in this fall, and this meant that all the people of this fall remained in the town and the heroic resistance took shape. This, of course, is a source of pride for the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Information Society.
Part 2.
On April 18, 1943, Japanese Commander Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto left the Rabaul base in New Guinea for the Solomon Islands. It was the Admiral's last flight. On his way to the island, 16 U.S. fighter jets appear in the sky and attack the Admiral. After the shooting, the plane wing falls apart and the Admiral's plane crashes in the woods. The question is, where did the planes come from? How was Yamamoto's direction revealed? As the Second World War was drawing to a close, Roosevelt died and his deputy, Harry Truman, assumed power. 4 months later, Truman issued an order for an atomic attack on Japan so the World War could end with the U.S. display of power. Truman was seeking power. The liberated lands were war booties, and in his opinion, peace was an opportunity for the next war. For the U.S., the Soviet Union was a hostile force. Yesterday's comrade became today's foe. In 1965, ARPA launched a project to create a real network. The technology was based on a theory by Paul Barron, breaking messages to smaller packages. After an extensive endeavor, finally, on October 29, 1969, efforts were made to link up the first two nodes and establish what was later named ARPANET. We typed the letter L and we asked, "Do you see the L?" They said yes. We typed O and asked, "Do you see the O?" And they said yes. Then we typed G and the system crashed. The first link between the California and Stanford universities was set up. It was a success. The network was invented. He said the complicated receivers and processors were secretly transferred in special diplomatic packages and bags to the embassies and were used for surveillance after being installed.
See that structure at the top? It looks something like an Indian teepee with the little lightning rods on top. I watched them build that. I watched them construct it.
Duncan Campbell confirmed his claims. The tools in the U.S. embassies in Geneva and Berlin were of the same type. This part of Echelon was named the stateroom. Echelon services were improving by the day, and Mike Frost had more to reveal. As ordered by Margaret Thatcher, Echelon was used to spy on two UK cabinet members as well. Echelon's footprints could be traced in Princess Diana's death and the Mossad's revenge against the Munich incident. In 2000, James Woolsey, the CIA director, asserted that because of financial concerns, Echelon was involved in spying on industries and business as well. It led to big agreements by Boeing, which made European companies and experts lose jobs. The U.S. was stealing the Europeans' jobs as well.
That America was stealing European jobs.
A European delegation took a trip to Washington, but the U.S. canceled all meetings and the committee had to cut the trip short. The U.S. refused to answer the demands. On September 11th, 2001, something extraordinary happened. Two planes crash into the World Trade Center Twin Towers. Everyone was speechless and emotional. No one saw the tower's engineered collapse. The Western media mobilized the international community. The perpetrators should have been arrested and executed. Because of such incidents, people would be under surveillance along with the terrorists. Everyone forgot how Echelon abused the circumstances. Echelon was unbelievably tasked with fighting terrorism. The war on terror started. After a while, the U.S. tried to form a coalition to launch an invasion on Iraq. Before that, Western officials considered Echelon's services meager and insignificant. But when Colin Powell sought to compel the U.S. Security Council members to launch an attack on Iraq by unveiling the conversation between Iraqi Ba'athist commanders about hiding chemical weapons, Echelon's unbelievable capabilities to record conversations came to light. The conversations could be converted into text. echelon was higher than what was said. In 2003, the U.S. invaded Iraq, which led to the massacre of people. Julian Assange made a disclosure. After founding WikiLeaks, he took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy. The number of whistleblowers gradually increased. On June 5, 2013, young engineer Edward Snowden, who worked in the intelligence company Booz Allen Hamilton as a security contractor of the Defense Department, in an interview made a huge revelation. The NSA had launched a large-scale surveillance program on everything, even social networks. The internet was not safe.
It targets the communications of everyone.
He proved that the security cooperation between Western countries amid the Cold War contained the most secret mysteries in the West. Protect America Act of 2007 led to the creation of a secret program, a program to gather two types of data, metadata and content from all conversations. The program was called PRISM. The conspiracy theory collapsed. There was a real plot going on. Google, which was the main research engine for many people to search, watch videos, and send emails, was at the heart of PRISM. All of the information and activities by users on the internet was recorded, and the NSA astonishingly had direct access to the data by Google and other internet giants like Facebook, Apple, Yahoo, and even small companies. It would easily save the data. The agency had worked a miracle. The coding software had become an agent of spying. For example, journalists used Tor software to hide their own identities. They were supposed to use Tor to not be tracked so their identities wouldn't be revealed, but that didn't happen. There was a big lie. Everything was right in front of the agency's organization. Only 10% of the internet was used by ordinary people, and the remaining 90% was being controlled by the NSA. Snowden disclosed facts about Bull Run and Q-Score. The programs were used for coding telecommunication and online data. They had a budget of $800 million. The situation was chaotic, and the issue was taken to the Senate. James Clapper was grilled in the Senate meeting. He was questioned if the NSA had recorded any information on U.S. citizens. Clapper said no. He was dismissed for wrong testimony. Things were even worse in Britain. Even though the UK intelligence agency had a system to identify coded telecommunication through cable networks, it was intensely after influencing Hotmail, Google, Yahoo, and Facebook. Their espionage program was Tempora, which started in 2008 and became operational in 2011. The other program was Edge Hill. These programs had unique features. They worked with advanced mathematical techniques. For example, Edge Hill, that cost $250 million a year, could crack emails, bank documents, and medical documents. It could penetrate VPNs and secure layers and was trying to penetrate 4G smartphones. This program would damage facilities on purpose. The software was really dangerous. Why were the facilities so vulnerable? According to U.S. laws, the companies were forced to send their products to the agency to test them for supervision. The NSA and the CIA would change the design and make the facilities sent by the companies traceable and would turn them into spy tools. The NSA was seeking to carry on with its surveillance activities through free hubs and Wi-Fis, just like GPS devices. Verizon wireless software, with 100 million users, was also used as spyware. The The documents showed that the agency had penetrated international standards that had stress coding systems and had caused weaknesses in security standards. Snowden struck the coup de grace on the concept of standards and information technology. The NSA influenced international standards that encryption systems relied on, working covertly in 2006 to get its own version of draft security standards issued by National Institute of Standards and Technology, the NIST, and approved for worldwide use. Standard was at the service of the NSA. It was as if everyone was trying to take over in the espionage race. The FBI and CIA were well aware of the weaknesses of smart systems, but they wouldn't say anything about it for espionage purposes. They were taking advantage of the vulnerabilities.
I feel terrible about what happened to these Iraqi detainees.
I'd do it again in a minute.
George Bush's operation to get revenge for the 9/11 attacks started with widespread espionage activities. The basis for the espionage was the internet. But it wasn't the whole plan to get revenge. The U.S. was thirsty for power.
Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
The slogan, either you're with us or against us, led to the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. The ground was paved for international intranets. The coalition of eyes was formed. The information was classified and was provided only in a limited amount after receiving guarantees. The game had started. After a year, a 27 terabyte database was built in the Bagram Air Base data center that would save regional information. The Polish soldiers who were deployed in Afghanistan went to distant and tough terrains the U.S. troops wouldn't go. They received a tracking device in return for their favor and tried to help the U.S. more. But they weren't allowed to join the intelligence coalition in Afghanistan. Poland, along with several other NATO member states, was on the red list. The English-speaking countries that had historical and cultural roots in English islands had closer cooperation with each other compared to other countries, even in the occupation of Afghanistan. The coalition for Iraq was different. As they had to face a larger population, the agency rolled up its sleeves and simultaneously spied on 4 to 5 million Baghdad residents. The White House, the Defense Department, the FBI, and CIA had their own intranets. Gradually, it came to light that the number of the networks was much higher than already disclosed. Finally, top secret intranets that could transfer sensitive SCI information were unveiled. Interlink and Intellipedia were special software for the agency staff to share information from all over the world. One of their favorite subjects was Iran's nuclear activities that led to the Stuxnet malware. The information also showed who was strongly against the invasion of Iraq and how different countries assessed their national information. In 2013, the CIA's budget to topple governments increased to $15 billion. The NSA, that was only assigned with digital operations, issued a bill of at least $10.5 billion. They claimed that their mission was to protect the United States security.
Necessary to do the job to protect the American people from further attack.
The heavy investment on the NSA helped it become so advanced that in 2018, it could spy on all smartphones and completely control people and all cell phones. no phone was safe.
Are not especially good in protecting your privacy. Think right now.
What the NSA does has to do with encryption. It is the biggest employer of mathematicians in the world, either directly or indirectly. The NSA owns the biggest supercomputers in the world. The minimum amount of electricity bill in its headquarters in Maryland is $21 billion. The NSA supervises all processes of transfer of information in any shape or form. That is, an email sent from a room to the adjacent room is done under the watchful eyes of the NSA. Where does the NSA's power come from? Administratively, the NSA belongs to the Defense Department and works under the supervision of the DNI. The NSA's director is at the same time head of the Central Security Service as well. The NSA is an expert in signal intelligence and provides services to other intelligence agencies. The basis for the NSA's widespread activities are telecommunications and national security acts. The Telecommunications Act was ratified in 1996. The act stems from a 1934 act that's still binding. The president has the authority to control all communication in case of a threat posed by war. It means he can shut down the internet. But the internet is formed based on the activities of companies that provide internet services that are known as the internet's spinal cord. In 2010, U.S. senators claimed the right and ownership to the internet so they could shut it down as and when they wished. They put it to a vote to register the internet as a national asset. The motion was repealed without being put to a vote. The reason was the direct and indirect benefits of the internet for the U.S. The internet was a source of revenue and widespread espionage, so it couldn't be specific to a country. The U.S. economy was dependent on the internet, the NSA, and DARPA. In this economic model, the circumstances should lead everyone to anxiously use the internet. The internet was the attractive factor that facilitated other plans. It worked as a catalyst. On the one hand, shutting down the internet would cause concern in other countries and make them create their own national networks to transfer data. And making those facilities in other countries would reduce the possibility for espionage. So the national networks shouldn't have been created by other countries, and people shouldn't use them under the slogan of the internet for all, so intelligence agencies could carry out their operations well. The U.S. spy agencies came into being according to the National Security Act and spread like wildfire. Soon, there were 17 main agencies and many more departments. The intelligence spending in the U.S. is provided under two programs, the National Intelligence Program and the Military Intelligence Program. The spending for the two programs increased from $72 billion in 2013 to about $86 billion in 2020. Officials behind the two programs and all other institutions were called the U.S. Intelligence Community, or the IC. The IC considers itself a federation of its own constituents. It sets the goals and priorities. It spends billions of dollars for different intelligence projects. Some programs are introduced as a 10-year espionage program, and some others are for longer periods. The IC power increased after the 80s, when analyzing data became a focal point, so it would help politicians by sifting through the information. In fact, it was discovering less expensive solutions to tackle America's problems. The information was fast increasing. Managing it was a tough challenge. The solution was investing on projects, the same policy that led to the creation of DARPA and advanced systems in the past decades. A project named Massive Digital Data Systems, the MDDS, was introduced. Universities were handed over control over the project. As IC demanded, Dr. Anita Jones, a scientist at the University of Virginia, became the director of DARPA. She had been on the board of directors at the Meacher firm since 1988, so she followed up on the project through Meacher. Huge finances were directly allocated to the best projects introduced. It gave a technological boost to Silicon Valley's tech companies. The most outstanding issue was a successful search engine to exactly find what they're looking for faster than other search engines. Professor Jeffrey Albin and his colleagues, who had previously worked with DARPA, referred two students to DARPA supervisors. They were really instrumental in ranking the pages, Sergey Brin and Larry Page. Brin and Page started their work with the funding for the Digital Library Initiative, the DLI, a multi-agency program sponsored by the National Science Foundation, NASA, and DARPA. Two intelligence directors were in charge of directing the program, and as the search was progressing, they held regular meetings with Brin. The funding by the NSA and CIA were indirectly transferred to their bank accounts and other projects. In their article in 1988, which was published in the Bulletin of the Technical Committee of the American Compute Society on Data Engineering, Page and Brin described page ranking methods and stated that the article was sponsored by the American Science Foundation. The amount awarded by the foundation was over $4.5 million. After a while, they unveiled Google. No one knew how it was related to intelligence agencies. In September 1998, two technology entrepreneurs invested $100,000 on Google each.
In the limelight.
Heading a high-ranking political economic delegation, Iranian President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi has visited Indonesia in response to the invitation of Indonesian President Joko Widodo. In this regard, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has penned an article on the significance of this trip, which was published by Indonesia's English-language newspaper, the Jakarta Post. What you are about to hear is the full text of this piece. Please stay with us. The state visit of the Islamic Republic of Iran President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi to Jakarta in response to the invitation of President Joko Widodo marks not only a turning point in the bilateral relations between the two countries, but also the commencement of a new chapter in the relations between the two great nations. The stance of the two countries in the two regions of the West Asia region and East Asia, cultural and civilizational commonalities and weighty potential for cooperation in various fields, alongside the new requirements of the international order, herald the opening of a new era of relations between the two countries, hinged on respect and mutual understanding. The diplomatic ties between Iran and Indonesia are now entering their eighth decade, while the relations between the two great nations have deep roots in history. The people of the two countries, centuries ago, were able to establish profound bonds with each other through Islam, and Iranian and Indonesian Muslim scholars and intellectuals had beneficial interactions in past centuries. The linguistic ties between the two countries also serve as further evidence of the historical interactions between the people of the two nations throughout Asia. A considerable number of Persian words in the Indonesian language and shared assets such as Imam Muhammad Ghazali testify to the depth of historical connections between them and provide a basis for deepening the relations between the two nations. The Islamic Republic of Iran, within the framework of a balanced, smart, and dynamic foreign policy, attaches a special prominence to the development of relations with Indonesia. Fortunately, this determination exists on both sides, and the authorities of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Republic of Indonesia are resolute to create the required